Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm Dave Marshall.
And I'm Liz Martin.
So how are you doing, Liz?
I'm pretty good. I'm home in Canada for Christmas, so
enjoying the festive period.
Yeah, and enjoying the snow. It's currently snowing, so it's nice. Wow. Yeah.
Pretty. We had snow on Boxing Day here.
Ooh, that's not normal.
I know. Big shout out to everyone in the Southern Hemisphere who probably won't be having snow for Christmas.
No, not so much snow now, I guess.
So, where are you actually from? Whereabouts in Canada?
I'm from Edmonton, or I grew up in Edmonton, which is in Alberta, so Western Canada, near the mountains-ish.
Okay, and you did your undergrad degree there?
Yes, I did my undergrad at the University of Alberta.
And so I believe that is where you met Professor Phil Curry, who we're interviewing today.
Yes, exactly. So I did my undergrad thesis with Phil Curry. So I know him from my undergrad and have done field work with him a couple of times from meeting him in my undergrad. So that is how I know him.
So we won't give anything away because I think we talk about lots of that in the actual interview.
Yes.
So can you sum up Phil Curry for us, please? I mean, I'm an arthropod worker. I didn't really know about Phil until we did the interview. So for those who don't know.
So how to sum up Phil Curry without giving away the interview? Well, Phil Curry is, I guess, one of the most well-known dinosaur paleontologists around today. He's, you know, managed to do field work and work on specimens from all over the world, every continent he's made it to. And he's definitely one of the busiest and most well-known of the dinosaur paleontologists, I guess.
Cool. And we met him at SVP, another one of the interviews we did in Berlin.
Yeah, so I guess this is our last big interview from SVP, actually.
Our last dinosaur one.
Yeah.
So yeah, all of you invertebrate and plant fans and miscellaneous, we'll get to you.
Phil used to be he was one of the presidents of SVP a couple of years ago. So he's always at SVP. So it's a good chance to catch up with him there since he's all over the place. I mean, I'm here and I thought I'd be able to interview him while I was home, but no, he's not in Edmonton now.
Okay, so let's just jump straight into the interview. Won't keep you waiting any longer. It really is a good one. So if you could let us know what you think in the comments, and please like and share on Facebook and Twitter. And I hope you enjoy this episode.
Yeah, hope it's a good one. Phil, today you're considered one of the leading experts in dinosaur paleontology. Can you give us a little bit of your background, how you got there, and what your past experience is?
Well, it started a long time ago when I was 6 years old. that time I found a plastic dinosaur in a cereal box, and that got me interested in dinosaurs, believe it or not. But when I was about 11 years old, I read a book by Roy Chapman Andrews called All About Dinosaurs. And the book All About Dinosaurs was, in fact, all about being a paleontologist. And as soon as I learned that you could get into a profession where you were actually paid to do something I really loved, then I decided the day I read the book that that's exactly what I was going to do. And because I was raised in the Toronto area, I had access to the dinosaur displays at the Royal Ontario Museum. So I think where a lot of kids lose interest in dinosaurs, I was always able to go to the museum and be reinforced in terms of my interest. And it also helped because I could go talk to various professors and find out how I should pursue my education. So basically, I was very lucky in that even by the time I was in high school, I knew exactly what courses I'd have to take and what path I'd have to follow to become what I became.
Very cool.
So you are now, I guess, professor of dinosaur paleobiology and Canada research chair?
Oh, yes. It's a mouthful for sure.
Yes, at the University of Alberta. So what did you do before getting to the U of A?
It's kind of a fairy story, too, in the sense that when I went to... Well, when I took my undergraduate, it was at the University of Toronto. But at that time, but at that time, it was generally impossible to be hired by the place where you took your education. And because Toronto had one of the only jobs in Canada where I could expect to work on dinosaurs, then I decided I had to go somewhere else to study so that I couldn't, you know, so that I wouldn't eliminate Toronto from my career path. And consequently, I went to McGill University in Montreal. And I was very curious because I planned on taking my time because I knew that there weren't very many jobs in dinosaur paleontology in the world. There was probably only half a dozen at the time anywhere. And so your chances of getting a job are not all that good. And there were two in Canada, and both of them were occupied by people who were relatively young, so they weren't going to retire in a hurry. And so I started this path of, you know, taking my time doing my graduate degree simply because I felt that by doing that, I would get more publications, I would meet more people, network better, have a better chance of getting experience in the field, and so on. But it worked fine for my master's degree, and I did 3.5 years on my master's degree, and then I started my PhD. And I mean, 2 years into my PhD, and then I got a call from one of my old professors, Loris Russell, at the University of Toronto, and said, "Do you know there's a job that opened up in Alberta, and it sounds just like you?" And so I applied for it. Up to that point, it had been basically held by a person who worked on fossil mammals. But they were really interested in getting somebody to work on dinosaurs. And here I was in my second year of my PhD program, you know, long before I ever planned on getting a job, interviewing for this job. And there were many people who were competing with me, but I walked into the room and I just felt, you know, this is my job. It's quite bizarre because when I walked out of the room after the interview, I shook my head and said, "Who was that who did that interview? That wasn't me." Because I just, you know, I just felt so strongly about the whole thing. And in the end, although I was competing against people who already had their PhDs, in fact, most of them worked on fossil mammals, and they really wanted somebody to work on dinosaurs. So in a way, it was exactly what my job was. So I started at the Provincial Museum of Alberta in Edmonton, which is now known as the Royal Alberta Museum. And after about 4 years there, we were lucky enough to be able to create a new dinosaur museum. And that's because I'd been so successful at collecting dinosaurs that there was no room left in the Provincial Museum for dinosaurs. And so the opportunity came up to build a new museum. And this was in connection actually with the UNESCO World Heritage Site designation of Dinosaur Provincial Park initially. But politically, it ended up shifting from Dinosaur Park to Drumheller. I did the original proposal for the Terrell Museum of Paleontology and, of course, stayed with it for more than 23 years.
Wow. It's funny that like all of the original stuff was in kind of Eastern Canada, Toronto, Montreal, when that's not where any of the fossils are, but that's where...
Exactly. And then, you know, that's very much, it's very true of the States as well. I mean, there was no question that the best dinosaur resources came from the Western U.S. And yet the museums that had all the dinosaur collections, of course, were New York and Pittsburgh and Philadelphia and places like that. But in the 1970s, with the beginning of the dinosaur renaissance, we saw in all of North America a shift from the major centers that hadn't really done any work on dinosaurs in many years to the West, where new museums were being created and old museums that had never had dinosaurs before wanted to build dinosaur collections.
So, of course, you spend a lot of your time in Alberta and doing a lot of field work in Alberta. why have you kind of decided to work there over sort of other areas in the world or anything? What is it about Alberta that kind of draws you there?
Well, in part it goes back to when I was 12, and I, of course, looked in the Royal Ontario Museum and I saw all the dinosaurs were from Alberta, so I knew at that point I was going to work in Alberta. So that's part of it. But really it is one of the very, very best places in the entire world for dinosaur specimens. And, of course, the dinosaurs are late Cretaceous in age. They're at their zenith in terms of their diversity. And Alberta is just a fantastic place to collect specimens. Mm. A place like Dinosaur Provincial Park, for example, has produced over 700 dinosaur skeletons over the years. In addition to that, you have hundreds of bone beds with thousands or millions of bones. It's a fantastic place. And even after more than, 120 years worth of research in the park on dinosaurs, we're still turning up new species of dinosaurs. Uh-huh. So it really is a very fantastic place. And of course, it's not literally my backyard, but it's close enough within a few hours of where I live. And so that's certainly a very big attraction. But it's not limited to Dinosaur Park. Virtually all over the province, we have dinosaurian resources. And I live in Edmonton now, and in the southern part of Edmonton, I can collect dinosaurs a scant 10 kilometers from my house.
Yeah, very conveniently located bone bed right within the city limits, which is quite nice. And on university property, exactly. If I remember correctly. So, how many, if you could give an estimate of how many different sort of sites or, I mean, obviously sites is kind of a difficult question because you may find one here and one over there. But if you could give an estimate of how many different fossil-rich areas in Alberta there are.
Well, for dinosaurs alone, I'm sure there's at least 30 or 40. Mm. And virtually every time we go out and look and decide, okay, we should be able to find dinosaurs over here because nobody's looked there and it's the rocks are the right age and we have exposures there, you go there and you'll find dinosaurs. Mm. So in a way, the limitation really is by how many people you have and what your budget is like in terms of whether or not you can work those. But virtually all of the late Cretaceous terrestrial beds in Alberta, all of the early Cretaceous beds in the foothills of Alberta, and so on, they all produce dinosaurs.
Okay. So there's nowhere that you've been that you've kind of said there should be dinosaurs here and there's just nothing.
So far, never. I mean, the closest I've come to that, I guess, is up in the Arctic and in Antarctica, where, you know, you work long days, but even there are dinosaurs. It takes an awful lot more work to find them, that's all.
Yes. So what kind of preservation do you usually get in Alberta? Do you get 3D, or are they generally crushed or disarticulated, articulated?
Well, the most common thing, of course, is disarticulated, because it's a lot easier for, after an animal dies, for its bones to get dispersed than for the animal to stay together and get buried in its entirety. However, having said that, you know, there are still more articulated skeletons in Alberta than most other places in the world, and the preservation can be absolutely superb. We've collected dinosaurs in Dinosaur Park, for example, that are complete from the tip of the nose to the tip of the tail, every single bone there.
Wow.
And the skeletons very often have skin impressions associated with them. Sometimes we find the scleral plates in the iris of the eye or the stapes associated with the ear. One case, we've even found coprolite in Alberta, and this was a tyrannosaur coprolite. He'd obviously been eating a hadrosaur because it was chopped up hadrosaur bones in the coprolite.
Wow.
But inside that coprolite, which is a very special micro-environment, I guess, there was preserved muscle tissue as well. So preservation can be quite remarkable in Alberta. Of course, your chances of finding such exquisite specimens are not as good as finding a specimen that's been eaten by a tyrannosaur 75 million years ago, or a specimen that's been eroding for many years before you found it. But nevertheless, a lot of specimens have been found of that kind of preservation. In terms of how hard and soft the rock is, well, they can be very hard. We collected two Tyrannosaurus rex specimens, for example, in the 1980s. And both those specimens took more than 20 man years to prepare.
Wow.
Because there was hard rock, and the specimens were difficult to get out, and of course it's a very big animal. However, in other situations, we've got dinosaurs that are preserved in virtually unconsolidated sands, and you can literally take your finger and rub the sand off the bones.
Wow. So how does that preservation compare to some of the really nice, like, Lagerstättens and stuff that comes out of China, that sort of well-preserved?
Yeah, the Lagerstättens are certainly a different situation because the rocks tend to be, of course, very flat-bedded, thin beds, and they tend to be a little bit on the hard side. The specimens tend to collapse into usually two dimensions. I mean, that's not entirely true, of course. They have some three-dimensionality to them as well. But, of course, the Lagerstättens, because of the geochemistry as well as the sediments that they are preserving the animals, allow preservation of things like feathers and fur, which is quite remarkable. We don't see that as often in places like Dinosaur Provincial Park. However, having said that, we do now have at least four specimens of theropods with feather impressions on them in Alberta as well.
Really? I didn't know that. I knew there was maybe one or two, but I didn't know there were
many. We're up to four.
That's exciting. There's also been some feathers found in amber as well, right?
Yeah, feathers in amber are kind of interesting because when we first started finding them more than 20 years ago, we have these fantastic amber sites in Alberta as well, where you can literally get one insect out of every 50 pieces of amber you pick up.
Wow.
And we can pick up to thousands of pieces of amber in a single day from some of these sites. But the feathers, when we first found them, we didn't think too much of them. They were, you know, they're not complete because the pieces of amber are relatively small, but you could see that there were feathers inside. We just assumed they were birds. But of course, after the discovery of feathered dinosaurs in China, it kind of took the lid off in terms of your thinking. And looking at these feathers again more recently, we realized that, in fact, these weren't normal bird feathers. These, in fact, were probably dinosaur feathers. You don't have the barbules associated with them. They look a little bit like down feathers, but they're not. They're a slightly different structure than them as well. And these fit very nicely the proto-feathers, so-called proto-feathers, we find on some of the feathered dinosaurs in China.
That's very cool. I know a lot of some of the dinosaurs, at least, that come out of Alberta are quite commonly found. You find certain ones more than others. What are the most common dinosaurs that you normally, you know, if you go out on a day in Dinosaur Provincial Park, what are you most likely to find?
So one of the most common dinosaurs we find are duck-billed dinosaurs. And of course, there's many species of duck-billed dinosaurs in Dinosaur Provincial Park. It's probably the richest single place in the world for duck-billed dinosaurs in terms of numbers of individuals, the amount of bone you find, number of skeletons, and their diversity for one single place. They're quite remarkable. But ceratopsian dinosaurs, of course, are also fairly common. In fact, we have these enormous bone beds in Dinosaur Provincial Park, which are made up of single species of ceratopsian dinosaurs. And not surprisingly then, given the fact that quite a few of these ceratopsian bone beds are composed of the dinosaur Centrosaurus, we also find a lot of articulated skulls and skeletons of Centrosaurus. But you would know that because you've worked on that animal.
Yes, I have done a lot of time looking at Centrosaurus over the last several years. But I guess you get nice big articulated skulls as well as smaller little bits and pieces here and there, but Centrosaurus is
a pretty cool dinosaur all by itself.
yeah, Centrosaurus is a neat one.
And of course, the nice thing about something like Centrosaurus is the fact that because there are so many specimens and they represent so many different age groups, small to adult, then of course you can get a lot of information about what a dinosaur species really is. You can see the amount of variation between individuals, between babies and adults, between males and females, and that just is really cool stuff.
That's something I was going to ask, was about any sort of sexual dimorphism. Can you, with things like Centrosaurus, and I know there's also Pachyrhinosaurus bone beds, can you start to see anything about the different groups and if there's differences between males and females?
We do suspect that there are differences between males and females. And of course, there was a very nice study done by Peter Dodson back in the 1970s looking at the duckbill dinosaurs of Dinosaur Park. And it's a good cautionary tale, though, because Peter did all the work of measuring the specimens, and when he graphed them up, he realized that there was almost always for these duckbill dinosaurs two morphs at adulthood. And so it was speculated that one morph was the female, one morph was the male. The only problem was that when we went back and went to the quarries again and then tabulated the altitude and their position next to a formational contact in the lower part of the Dinosaur Park formation, we realized that all of the females were one level, all the males were at a different level altogether, which makes that impossible.
Yeah, I guess it's a bit difficult if they're living at different times.
Yeah, so you do have to be very careful with it. And with horned dinosaurs, we also see that we have animals that look very different at adulthood, but very often you don't have specimens that are complete enough when you're taking them out of bone beds. Mm-hmm. And so you're never sure if the fact that, say, this Pachyrhinosaurus, which has a horn growing out of the middle of its head and the middle of its shield, is a male, and the one without is a female, or if in fact that's just individual variation, or perhaps it's just something to do with the age of the animal, or you know, a minute difference in size. We don't really know. We suspect that we have sexual differences of both duckbill dinosaurs and horned dinosaurs, but it takes many, many years of going through a lot of specimens to be able to prove that to everybody's satisfaction.
Mm. Is there anything similar in theropod dinosaurs?
Well, theropods, of course, are relatively rare animals.
Yeah.
Generally, we pick up one skeleton of a theropod, or like a tyrannosaur, for example, for every 20 skeletons we pick up of plant-eating dinosaurs.
Okay.
And that's very normal for an ecosystem. However, with theropod dinosaurs, of course, you have another way of assessing whether or not they're males or females. And that was this fortuitous discovery by Mary Schweitzer down in Montana of a broken Tyrannosaurus rex bone. And that led to her doing an investigation that showed that that particular Tyrannosaurus rex had what's called intermedullary bone. The intermedullary bone is something that allows a female bird today, or dinosaurs obviously back then, to store extra bone inside their hollow bones so that when they're laying eggs that they have a place to borrow the calcium from rather than their hollow bones. And so now there's a number of theropod dinosaurs which have been shown to be in fact females based on the presence of intermedullary bone. So that's pretty cool. Now we can turn that around and start looking at the anatomy of these animals and see what consistent differences there are. It's been noted, for example, that with some modern lizards and crocodilians, you can have a difference in numbers of hemal spines, the spines underneath the tail, which theoretically would allow the female to have a little more room so that she could lay the eggs. So the female would have fewer hemal spines, for example. Fortunately, it hasn't been proved unequivocally for modern animals, let alone dinosaurs. But still, if you know it's a female and it does have fewer hemal spines, maybe you've got something.
Hmm. That's really interesting. Of course, you said theropod dinosaurs are much more rare, but you have found a bone bed of, is it Albertosaurus?
Yeah. In fact, we didn't find it, though.
Oh, no.
It's a really great story because it was found in 1910. And when Barnum Brown came to Alberta to collect dinosaurs for the American Museum of Natural History in 1910, his very first good sight was an Albertosaurus bone bed. I don't think he realized it, really. He did realize that there were multiple specimens of this tyrannosaur there. And so he collected enough, but he never got around to actually publishing on it. So when I found the old collections in New York and realized that he had collected parts of 9 skeletons of Albertosaurus from one single place,
wow.
Then I determined I had to re-find the site. Got lucky because there was one photograph which showed the site in the context of the landscape. And more by dumb luck than anything else, managed to refind the site and reopen it. And now we have more than 20 Albertosaurus out of a single quarry.
Wow.
And the Albertosaurus outnumber the duckbill dinosaurs by about 10 to 1. So it's a very unnatural situation. And it's pretty cool that this Tyrannosaur is represented in this bone bed by everything from 2 meter long animals to 11 meter long animals. And so again, we can look at differences in age within one of these large Tyrannosaurs.
Wow. So what do you think caused that? Is that something like a group of Tyrannosaurs, a family group, or is it some sort of a predator trap? What is the thought on that?
We've gone through a lot of thinking about it, of course, and a lot of investigation. In fact, we worked there for more than a dozen years trying to find more evidence for, first of all, what would have caused an accumulation like that, and why would all those dinosaurs have been there? We know it's a short-term accumulation. It's not something that took place over many years. It was probably within days, weeks, or months at the very most. Hmm. When you think about it, in terms of modern ecosystems, there's no question that you can't just find them together like that by accident. They have to be there for a reason. And given the fact that they're all ages, it seems unlikely that they were there for breeding. Because why would a two-year-old animal be there, for example? It's also unlikely that they were there for feeding, because we never found any evidence of tooth marks on any of the hadrosaur bones that are in the same bone bed. You know, when you look at the home ranges on large animals like that, I mean, this is a group that's large enough that it must have had a home range of hundreds of square kilometers. So to find them all concentrated in one spot seems unlikely as well, unless these animals in fact were together at the time that they died, which means that they were together very close before the time that they died. So I think we have very strong evidence that Tyrannosaurs, at least at certain times, were gregarious. They moved in groups.
Interesting. So are they found, are they articulated or are they disarticulated?
It's an interesting site because it's almost certainly exactly where the animals died.
Okay.
If you follow the same beds in one direction, the bones disappear very quickly. Where we find the bones starting is where Brown excavated, and most of the material there is in fact articulated and associated.
Okay.
But the further you get away from it, and I should say that this bone bed extends for almost half a kilometer.
Oh, wow.
When you get further away from that point, you find things become progressively more and more disarticulated. In other words, they were washing down through the river system and being spread out, because the larger bones wouldn't be carried as far and the smaller bones be carried a lot further.
Hmm. Oh, that's interesting. There's been a couple of other big finds that you've had recently from Alberta and Dinosaur Provincial Park. One in particular that I can think of is the juvenile ceratopsian. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Well, you know, Dinosaur Park, in spite of the fact that it's so remarkable for preservation and you get such good specimens, there really is a preservational bias in favor of big dinosaurs. And there's lots of reasons for that. Of course, tyrannosaurs were big animals with very big mouths. And if you were a small dinosaur, the chances are that whether you were living or dead, if he caught you, he'd eat everything. There wouldn't be much left. So we don't find very many small dinosaurs for that and other reasons. And we're always curious, of course, about what the small dinosaurs look like. We can find isolated bones, but if you find isolated bones and you don't know, for example, that, say, an isolated upper leg bone belongs to an animal the same size as a skull bone from a small dinosaur, because you have nothing to link them. And so all you need to do, though, is find one good specimen. that fills in that gap, and then suddenly you can start arranging things in orders. You have some sense of what kind of changes the animal's going through in its body proportions as it's getting older. So a couple of years ago, in 2010, I was walking through the Badlands in an area that we'd walked many, many times before, and I was walking up a hill and looked in the cliff beside me, and I saw something that looked suspiciously like a ceratopsian frill, but it was tiny. And I convinced myself, no, this is probably not a ceratopsian frill. That would be just too much good luck. It's probably just a turtle shell. But I worked on it, and sure enough, it turned into a ceratopsian skull, which then turned into a whole skeleton, with the exception of the front limbs, which had been eroded away, actually probably thousands of years ago, into an old sinkhole. But it's a remarkable specimen. It's a meter and a half long, the whole specimen. It's an animal called Chasmosaurus. A full-grown Chasmosaurus is about 5 meters to 6 meters long. This animal is so well preserved that all the bones are articulated, and we even have the little scleral plates in one of the eyeballs, and we have skin impressions covering one side of the body.
Wow. So with something like Chasmosaurus, how can you tell? I would guess that the skeleton changes quite a bit, especially its frill and its skull would change quite a bit from a juvenile to an adult. So how can you, what kind of characters do you look at to tell that that's a Chasmosaurus rather than some other type of ceratopsian?
Luckily, even baby dinosaurs do have discrete characters sometimes that tell you which dinosaur they are. So if we looked at the skull overall, I mean, when we were excavating this specimen initially, we just assumed it was probably a baby Centrosaurus, because Centrosaurus is much more common at that level in Dinosaur Provincial Park. But once we'd uncovered the squamosal, we realized that the squamosal bone, which is the back part of the lower cheek area in a ceratopsian dinosaur, has a very distinctive shape, and there's no way this thing was Centrosaurus. This thing had to be Chasmosaurus. As we continued to excavate the specimen, of course, we saw more characters like that. But the truth is, as you say, with baby dinosaurs, it is very difficult sometimes to identify them. If you looked at the specimen overall, like a baby Centrosaur, you know, the frill is very short. It doesn't have any real ornamentation on it. The eyes are large and so on, and they look quite similar to each other. But still, those discrete characters help you identify things.
That's really interesting. I remember hearing about the baby ceratopsian and getting really excited.
It was exciting.
Yeah. Do you think, is that your kind of favorite find? Do you think that's the...
No, I think, you know, it's been very good being in Alberta, because we've had so many good discoveries over the years. You know, for me, because I work on tyrannosaurs as well as ceratopsians, I like some of the tyrannosaur finds as well. One story I like to tell is I was photographing the Badlands one day, and I dropped my camera case, rolled down the hill. I went down the hill to pick up my camera case, and it landed on a Tyrannosaur skeleton, which turned out to be a Diplodocus skeleton with skull.
Oh, wow.
I'd like to think that I would have found it anyway, but the fact was it was completely fortuitous. But, and then I'd have to say that the discovery of dinosaur eggs in southern Alberta was probably the biggest charge I ever got. Because, you know, we had for years heard about Jack Horner's discoveries down in Montana, and Jack always threatened he was going to come up and find eggs for us if we didn't do it. But one year we went down to the American border, and sure enough, we found that there was lots of dinosaur egg shell. It was a good place to find things. So we had a 3-week expedition. And, you know, on the very last day, when one of my technicians, Kevin Ollenbach, was supposed to be back of the truck, he wasn't there. And he finally came over the hill, and he was so excited that he was babbling. I mean, it was really hard to understand what he was saying, but three words came out: eggs, babies, embryos, that you could understand. So we followed him over the hill, and sure enough, on this hillside, There were baby bones and eggshell showered all the way down the hill.
Wow.
And we crawled our way up, and I can remember being so excited. It was unbelievable. I mean, at one point, I picked up a bone, turned it over, and I saw all these little teeth.
Wow.
And I'm completely professional about this. I dropped it on the ground, rubbed my eyes, and then picked it up again. I couldn't believe it. And then we finally got to the level where all this stuff was coming out, and there was an egg in the hillside, nice round circle about the size of a volleyball, and the egg had been sectioned by erosion, so you just saw the circle of shell, and in the middle of it was all these baby bones.
Wow.
So that was probably the most exciting discovery, mostly because we predicted we would find them there, and that's exactly what happened.
What kind of dinosaurs are they?
This is a duckbill dinosaur that we eventually published on with Jack Horner and called Hippacrosaurus devonshire.
Very cool. So, obviously, dinosaurs are what make it the most famous with Dinosaur Provincial Park. But do you find often other bones? I know you mentioned earlier turtle shells. So, how often do you find other things like marine reptiles or pterosaurs?
Well, pterosaurs are very rare, and that's not a big surprise because their bones are so, so thin. In fact, when we first found our very first Quetzalcoatlus-type animal in Dinosaur Park, the bone, which is lower leg bone, had been sectioned by erosion, and it looked just like the egg I described.
Wow.
Because the bone was so thin, and there was so much space inside, and of course the it had been cross-sectioned, so it did look like an egg. Mm. And then when we dug it up, we realized it was a pterosaur bone. But we've been able to, over the years, find quite a few bones of these Ashdarchids, these big pterosaurs. And one of the most exciting, though, was a single skeleton. And unfortunately, we only had 9 bones of that single skeleton, at least unless we can move about 150 meters of rock. But one of the bones, in fact, had been eaten by one of these little velociraptorine theropods. And the local version of that's called Sornithelestes, but it's very much like Velociraptor. And what we found first were tooth marks from this dinosaur on these pterosaur bones. And then we actually found a broken tooth stuck inside the pterosaur bone from Sornithelestes.
Wow. That's really... Oh. That's interesting. I want to see that one, but I haven't seen it yet.
But other types of animals, of course, there are many. And although small animals like baby dinosaurs are very rare in Dinosaur Park, we do find their teeth and isolated bones. And in fact, we know of well over 100 other species that are not dinosaurs. So mammals, birds, lizards, snakes, crocodiles, alligators, fish of different kinds, and so on. And so it's a very rich fauna. And in addition to that, there's now known almost 500 species of plants associated with those animals in Dinosaur Provincial Park.
Wow. So
a very rich ecosystem.
Hmm. Can you tell us anything about any new finds from over the summer, if you found anything exciting over the summer in the field?
Well, we got lots of really exciting stuff this year, and I won't tell you the best one, but it's in fact has to be secret for the next year or so. but we did get some pretty spectacular specimens, another nice ceratopsian skull and skeleton that is about a half-grown animal that we're going to try and take out next year. And some very interesting theropods, and more evidence of footprints and eggs and so on. So I would say we had an exceptional year this year.
Excellent. Always good to hear that there's still new things and lots of interesting things coming out.
Exactly.
Do you think that there's still lots to find? Do you think we're anywhere near the number of species there actually were, or anything?
I think when you're not involved in dinosaur studies, you tend to think that there's over 1,000 species of dinosaurs known now. How many more can we discover? But then you look at a place like Dinosaur Park, and with almost 50 species, I mean, 50 species is what a good large percentage of all known dinosaurs from one single site in the world. 5% of dinosaurs from one single site and ecosystem. Mm. And dinosaurs existed for 150 million years over the entire planet. And we know that in the same time as Dinosaur Park in Mongolia, we have another site called Nemegt, and there's almost another 50 species. So only two sites, two of the richest ecosystems we have almost 10% of all known dinosaurs. And so we've got all the time to look at for dinosaurian history, that we don't have that kind of diversity of dinosaurs. We have all the different ecosystems all around the world that have never been investigated. There are literally, I think, thousands and thousands of dinosaurs yet to be discovered.
Wow. I look forward to continuing to go back to Alberta and look for things.
Exactly.
It amazes me that there could still be so much left to find. I know some people kind of say, well, we've found so much already, and there's so much in the back of museums that isn't being studied. So just, you know, you should hold back and stop looking for more fossils and just do what you can with the stuff that you have already found. But what kind of pushes you to keep going back each summer, even though you have a large collection already?
Well, of course, the erosion doesn't stop, and neither does development. And of course, in a place like Alberta, where new roads are being built and pipelines and mining is taking place and so on, then of course they are affecting the bedrock where the dinosaurs are being found, and new specimens are being found whether you like it or not. And secondly, the erosion rates in a place like Dinosaur Park are actually very high. It's almost a centimeter a year on average. And when you think about that, you know, I can cover Dinosaur Park, all of it, in about 5 years. But that means that by the time I've covered it once, if I go back to the original place, 5 centimeters of rock has eroded away and exposed entirely new specimens again. And, you know, we're always looking for better specimens. We're always looking for new species and so on. And we've been very lucky at this, because in the last 5 years, we've had a new dinosaur at a dinosaur park every year. And that's in spite of the fact that over a century of research has gone on in Dinosaur Provincial Park. We're still turning up new dinosaurs.
Wow. Obviously, we've spent most of the time talking about Alberta, which makes sense since that's where you do most of your work. But you've also done a lot of field work elsewhere. Where else have you been able to work?
Well, I've been lucky enough to work on every continent now.
Wow.
And so this year alone, we've worked not only in Alberta, but also in Mongolia. Mongolia is one of the places I really like working, because it is so similar to Alberta in terms of the animals we find, that I can understand the animals in Alberta better by looking at the Mongolian material. We've also worked in Greenland and Antarctica this year, and Argentina. So that's just one year.
Wow.
But yeah, this year was a very good year for us, because a dinosaur specimen that we collected in Mongolia in 1996 just got published as Zarapelta. A couple of years ago in Mongolia, we found a very interesting specimen that we realized was a very enigmatic dinosaur that was originally described in 1965, called Dinochirus. Dinochirus, known from big arms. And we found the, as it turned out, the second and third known skeletons of this animal, and turned out to be an even more bizarre dinosaur than anybody ever imagined it to be.
Yeah, I remember when that came out. That was just last week?
Yes.
Yeah, seeing the pictures of it and going, that's not at all what I expected.
Okay, that's a bit interesting. You've got a theropod dinosaur with a hadrosaur skull and hadrosaur feet.
Yeah.
And Spinosaurus spines and sauropod hips, and it's a real odd mix.
Yeah, it's a strange dinosaur. So, is the stuff in Mongolia, is it a very similar ecosystem as well? Is that why it's the same sort of dinosaurs you find?
Yeah, the ecosystem in Mongolia is similar, but not the same. So the Nemegt Formation is also fluvial deposit. So there was lots of vegetation and lots of water available for the dinosaurs. It was obviously very rich. The river was carrying an awful lot of sediment, so the dinosaurs got buried rapidly, just like they did in Alberta back 75 million years ago. And the fauna is just as rich as Dinosaur Provincial Park. I mean, there's no question. The two richest faunas right now are Dinosaur Park and the Nemegt in Mongolia. But they're also so similar because virtually every dinosaur we find in one, we'll find a relative of in the other if we haven't found it yet. So the only one we're missing so far in Dinosaur Park is Deinocheirus.
That'd be interesting to find a Deinocheirus-like thing in Dinosaur Park.
But what I really like about this site, too, though, is the fact that small specimens tend to get preserved better than the large specimens. So it's the reverse of Alberta. So if we want to understand what our own dinosaurs look like, the small ones, especially where we don't have whole skeletons, then Mongolia produces those skeletons to help us understand that better.
No, that's really interesting. I didn't realize that the stuff in Mongolia was so similar to the Albertan.
That's amazingly similar. In fact, one of the dinosaurs, Saurolophus, is the same in both
places. Ah, yes. I did know about Saurolophus, but I did not know that the rest of it was all so similar. I guess I've seen little bits and pieces of this being similar, but I didn't realize as a whole that most of them were very similar to the Albertan ones. Were they, just thinking kind of paleobiogeography wise, they weren't very close together in the late Cretaceous.
Now, during the late Cretaceous, Alberta was connected to Asia up through Alaska and down through Siberia. And, you know, we kind of feel that even though the environment is fluvial in Nemegt, there's something else going on there. I mean, this is a big river that's going through basically a desert environment, maybe like the Nile River of today. And consequently, it was an area that was relatively isolated in a lot of ways. So one would expect that even though you find things that are closely related because they were connecting probably on an annual basis up through Alaska and Siberia, nevertheless, they probably are not exactly the same. However, we've seen now some material from Siberia, which is very, very close to Alberta material. And, you know, unfortunately, it's isolated material, but it doesn't look any different. You know, these are specimens that you could find in Alaska or Edmonton or Drumheller.
Yeah, so the stuff in Alaska is also generally quite similar, correct?
The Alaska material is, again, very, very similar to the ones we find in especially the Drumheller area.
Well, I think that's all I had to ask for you today, Phil. Thanks for doing this. I'm glad that you were able to do this.
Well, you're very welcome. It's always fun talking about dinosaurs.
Yes. Yeah, it's great to have some kind of bigger names as well, and to be able to sit down and have some
water.
Yes, sit down and have some water. But no, thank you.
You're very welcome.
That. I enjoyed it. I learned things that I didn't even know about some of your finds and about Dinosaur Provincial Park.
Yeah, it's a pretty remarkable place.
Yeah. Yes. One day I will do field work there. One day.
No, I think most people who go there are just amazed by it.
It's
just,
yeah.
You know, if you have any experience somewhere else, if you your only experience is there, of course, then you get spoiled. And you tend to think it should be like that everywhere, and it's not.
I've got a question for you, Liz. Growing up in Alberta, did you always know that there was all of these dinosaurs just in the hills around your house?
Yeah, I knew that there were a lot of dinosaurs in southern Alberta, not necessarily that there are ones in Edmonton. So there's actually a bone bed in the city, like in the city limits. I didn't know that until I got to my undergrad. But you definitely know that there are dinosaurs all over the province and that it's a really good place for paleontology. I guess that's why Alberta is one of the only places you can do an undergrad in paleontology.
And did you always want to do an undergrad in paleontology? Did you do an undergrad in paleontology?
I did. Yeah, my undergrad is specialization. No, actually, it's honors in paleontology. So I have every one of my degrees is paleontology, which is kind of interesting. I didn't actually always want to do that. I didn't really know exactly what I wanted to do until probably 16 or 17. And then I realized that I really liked the biology of it, and trying to understand the biology of the extinct animals. And that was what I decided. And then realized that I could do it right in my hometown. So I thought, oh, why not? That sounds like a great idea.
So how much of an impact has Phil had on your life and your research directions? And
I guess he's had a fair bit of impact. Having him at my university as an undergrad was, I didn't actually realize that when I first started, because he was pretty new to the university when I started. So I didn't know he was there. And then, of course, I knew who he was. And then finding out that he was the person in charge of the paleontology program was kind of terrifying. But no, Phil's really great. And he's, you know, a great researcher, and he's a really nice guy. And he's been really helpful to me. Even though I decided to study something that I can't actually study in Alberta, because there's very few pterosaurs in Alberta, but, he's always been really helpful and, you know, invited me out to do field work with them whenever I'm around. And it's been definitely helpful having Phil Curry as an old supervisor that I can email and get help from. He's definitely been helpful. He's pushed me a lot.
Just drop a mail to Phil Curry.
Yeah. When he's around.
When he's around.
He also doesn't have a cell phone. So if you try to contact him, if he's not home, he won't get it.
Okay. And so what have we got coming up next? What kind of interviews have you got lined up?
I've got one lined up looking at kind of engineering in the fossil record and how we can use different sort of engineering techniques to understand specifically flight.
That sounds interesting. It writes up your streets as well. Is it specifically on pterosaurs?
It's with one of my supervisors who works mainly on pterosaurs, but he's also done a little bit with like Microraptor and early bird flight and that kind of thing. But as he's an engineer by training, he kind of goes about things in a different way than biologists would. So it's really interesting.
Yeah, it sounds like a good one to watch out for.
Yeah.
And then I will be in Australia for the next couple of weeks, so hopefully going to get a couple of interviews there.
Great. And I'm guessing they won't be vertebrate related.
Hey, you never know. I think they might be. We'll see. We'll see. Not ruling out anything at this stage.
Where will you be in Australia?
I'll be in Melbourne.
Okay.
Yep.
There's probably lots of stuff around there.
Yeah, it's going to be pretty hot. I mean, we've already done the interview with Tony Martin on Trace Fossils, and he was looking at dinosaur burrows over in Alberta, I think. Alberta. Over Australia. In Melbourne. So the only one of the few things that are around in the area we've already covered on Paleocast. So But I'm pretty sure there's quite a lot to do and see in Australia.
Oh yeah. So there's all the Ediacaran stuff as well.
Oh, I'd love to do that.
Yeah.
But as always, if there's any episodes that you want to hear in particular, anyone you want to have interviewed or any subjects you're particularly interested in, please let us know. There's always something we can do, someone we can talk to see if we can get those episodes for you. So don't be shy to ask. So we hope you've enjoyed this episode, and we'll see you again next time.
Yeah, we'll see you next time. Bye, everyone.
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Joe Keating, Laura Soule and Liz Martin. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at Paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.
Okay, so I've been sitting silently through that entire episode, but I have a few questions I wanted to ask.
First of all, did you ever finish your PhD?
Oh, yeah. I did finish it, but it really slowed it down because when I moved to the Provincial Museum of Alberta, I thought, well, you know, I should be able to do a little bit of work on my thesis during work time. Not a chance. Straight into it. So instead of the thesis being finished in 4 or 5 years, it was finished in 8 years. But I did it.
I think mine will be finished in about 8 years as well. So yeah. I'm in good company. Right, then, do you take volunteers? I mean, you're saying it's going to take you 5 years to cover the entire area, so can you just get in touch and go out digging?
Yeah, we do take volunteers. There are more people, of course, write in than we can actually take. Consequently, you know, if you're somebody who has a need for fieldwork experience, in other words, if you're a student in vertebrate paleontology and at some point it's going to come in useful for you in terms of getting your job, then of course you're going to have priority over somebody who is fixing cars somewhere. But, you know, that may be of use to us, too. It's hard to know. But we do take volunteers, for sure. And the volunteers that we take in Alberta are from all over the world. And we've a very long experience in this. We started doing that in 1977.
Oh, wow. Do you often find that members of the public will or commercial entities will get in touch and say, hey, we found these remains, can you come and have a look and see what they are, just in case there's something important? Do you find that that's more taking over your actual field work?
I would say that in terms of the discoveries that are made in Alberta, most of them are made by our own people. However, having said that, of course, when you have good museum displays, like at the Terrell Museum of Paleontology, then you have people who become very educated in what specimens should look like. And so they can go out in the Badlands and they can find things and they can recognize that, well, maybe this is important. And they will, in most cases, in fact, call you up and ask you to come in and see them. And this is very important because I would say that it's not a huge percentage of our discoveries, but it is a significant percentage. We do have type specimens from Alberta that were found by amateur collectors or by people who were interested in buying and selling fossils and not so much turning them over to professional collectors. In Alberta, they don't have a choice because it is illegal to collect without a permit anyway. But nevertheless, they didn't have to do that, and they did. So we've had very good luck, in fact, with people from the general public in terms of taking us to some very exciting discoveries. And even in the last 2 years, I mean, it's a couple of great examples because a pipeline north of Grand Prairie hit a big duckbill dinosaur, which is probably a brand new type of dinosaur. Skull, skeleton, the whole works is there. And then they were putting a water pipeline in just south of Edmonton, and they hit another duckbill dinosaur. This is in 1 year, in 1 month.
There's also been a couple of things found in the oil sands.
Yeah, there's been some very good specimens found in the tar sands. Most of these aren't dinosaurs. Most of these, of course, are marine reptiles. But about 5 years ago, one of the machine operators saw bones. And he stopped his machine. He'd hit a dinosaur, an ankylosaur, an exquisitely preserved ankylosaur. I have no idea how he ever saw that thing because it's black bone and black rock, and he was sitting a long way from the face where the machine was digging away at the rock, but he did, and he called in right away. He'd been at the Terrell Museum the day before he found that. And so things like that are pretty amazing when they happen. And also in southern Alberta, there are companies that mine ammonites. Oh, yeah. And the ammonites are turned into jewelry. This is done legally. The material is screened, however, but their operators as well work on very large drag lines. and they periodically spot fossils as well. Mm-hmm. And many marine reptiles in particular have been found in these ammonite mines in southern Alberta.
And then I don't know if you fully covered this, but the ecosystem seems really complete. You're missing the smaller animals, but is there anything else that's actually missing that you can see in other places around the world but you don't have in Alberta?
We certainly have things that are rare, and logically, you know, they just shouldn't be rare. So bird fossils, for example. We do find isolated bird bones, but almost always they're broken. And they're incredibly rare. We find more pterosaur bones than we find bird bones even. Hmm. But the funny thing is that we almost always find coracoid bones for birds.
Which of those?
Well, coracoid is associated with a shoulder girdle. And the coracoid, for some reason, seems to preserve better than anything else in Dinosaur Provincial Park. Hmm. And so most of our bird fossils, a good percentage of them, in fact, are coracoid bones. So that's very peculiar. We have another dinosaur even that it's a small dinosaur, man-sized dinosaur, and it's known almost exclusively from its lower jaws. And why its lower jaws? You know, there are taphonomic processes that are certainly eliminating things and say that, well, one of these days we are going to find better specimens as long as we keep doing what we're doing and keep vigilant about what's happening with erosion. But and I'm quite sure that there are still many new taxa, not just of dinosaurs, but of mammals and lizards and everything else that we are going to find in Dinosaur Provincial Park as time goes on.
And then finally, just on the ichnofossils, the trace fossils, how many of those do you get and how important have they been for recreating the ecosystems?
Well, trace fossils are very common in parts of Alberta. It was kind of a joke at one time that we would find all the coprolites in Saskatchewan on one side, find all the skeletons in Alberta on the other side, and then you go to the other side again to British Columbia and you would find all the footprints. But of course, that's all merged together now. We do find dinosaur footprints in Dinosaur Park, for example, but they're not common, and that's because the rock is so soft it tends to erode vertically, and so it goes right through the footprints instead of exposing the footprints as footprints. But they're there, and if you look for them, you'll find them. And the same with coprolites. Most people, of course, looking for skeletons don't think about looking for coprolites or trace fossils of any kind, and consequently, they'll walk right over them. Which is why it's always good to have new sets of eyes come in and look in different ways. I think we're very, very lucky in Alberta because of the fact we have all these different things. So we can correlate footprints, trackways even, in some cases, with specific types of dinosaurs, even if we can't be sure that that's a trackway made by a Diplodocus versus a Gorgosaurus, or Tyrannosaurus rex, if we don't know what the age of the rocks are. At least we can tell it's a tyrannosaur and that all those animals would move more or less the same way, and so we can get information on the biomechanics of the animals by looking at those footprints.
Cool.
Done. Boom. Guess how long?
How long is it?
10 minutes.